This is BBC Radio 3. It's 17 minutes past nine, and it's time for Nightwaves. I'm Philip Dodd.
Thanks very much, Martin. Tonight, Tony Judd, one of the world's leading historians and public intellectuals, in a passionate plea to remember the values of social democracy as he himself lies terminally ill in New York. And I go underwater, at least metaphorically, with a composer who believes that you can hear the music of the grass singing or the river wailing. Turner, Monet, Debussy, Handel. Artists have always been drawn to water, but no one, to my knowledge, has made water so integral an element to their work as Bill Fontana has in his new piece River Soundings, which opens later this week in the subterranean depths of Somerset House on London's Strand. In the publicity, Bill Fontana's described as a sound sculptor, but I was delighted to hear him, when I spoke to him, describe himself as a composer. All that distinguishes him is that he uses the sounds of nature as his bars and quavers. He began as a minimalist composer in San Francisco and went on to record sounds and orchestrate them. He's done this from the Venice Biennale to Tate Modern, and the titles tell all. Distant Trains, Satellite for Earbridge, Cologne, San Francisco are just two of them. His new work centres on the sounds of water mixed with foghorns and the bells of the boys, as well as images, and it's installed in Somerset House, but not in its grand upper rooms. It's in its lower depths, in the corridors and light wells or coal houses which punctuate them. I began my conversation with Bill Fontana at the top of some frightening stone stairs. Bill, where are you taking me? I know we're going down some vertiginous stairs.
Well, we're in Somerset House, about to begin an acoustic and architectural journey into the light wells of this old palace.
So we've just opened what looks to me like a coal shed.
Right, these are coal holes, but the river used to come into the building, and where we're standing now in the lower level of the light wells is actually in the level of the Thames. Here's Millennium Bridge.
This is the struts, I think, is the technical term,
right,
holding them together inside one of these dark, desolate places. Let's go inside.
We're in a coal hole off the light wells, and the image that's being projected is a close-up view of some of the cables on the London's Millennium Bridge. And the sounds you're hearing are from an accelerometer on some of these cables. And this...
So I'm actually hearing the sound of the cables.
The sounds of these cables, yes. But it's not a sound that you would hear if you were standing there. It's a sound that you might hear if you put your ear on it. But an accelerometer is a very, very sensitive sort of way to enter the material and find out what the material is doing.
There's a line in George Eliot's Middlemarch where she says, if we could hear the sound of grass singing, we would die the other side of silence. That's what you're after, isn't it?
Yes.
If you could hear the grass
singing.
Well,
I could.
You can hear the grass singing.
I could.
I like that. With your technology.
I could put a micro sensor on the grass, and you'd hear it, the material of the grass reacting to the wind. You'd hear it rubbing. Grass rubbing with each other, you find a whole universe of sound in that.
And is this something to do, were you born in San Francisco?
No, I was born in Cleveland.
So you were born in the middle of the kind of cornfields?
Well, Cleveland is an old by American standards, industrial city.
I suppose what I'm trying to work out is how you got from that industrial city to this kind of saturation in nature.
I grew up within walking distance to the Cleveland Orchestra, and I just was born with a love of music. And at a certain point during my adolescence, I guess I started. I used to think there was something wrong with me because I would start to hear sounds as being as beautiful as music, And I used to think, that must be a bit nuts.
So, in a way, you're trying to find the musicality in everyday life.
Exactly, exactly.
And in those circumstances, there are moments when I think of you like you belong... I mean, you started as a minimalist composer, but I think of you as belonging to that great nature tradition that takes you back to John Muir, the great 19th century nature writer of Yosemite Park. You're trying to find the kind of... the rhythms of everyday life.
Rhythms of everyday life and listening to the world with a natural ear. And I came to regard making music... For me, the act of listening is a way of making music. And so for years, I've used sound recording as a way to sort of investigate what that is. I've done this for 40 years, all over the world.
You're an old West Coast romantic, really, aren't you?
An old West Coast romantic, yes, yes.
And in those kinds of circumstances, you know, Cage's notion, you know, that if music is noise, all noise is music, that's not your position at all, really, is it?
Well, it is in a way, and it isn't in a way, because Cage used to always say in his lectures that music is continuous and listening is intermittent. And the music that's continuous is the ability of the listener to find and create music out of what he hears in the continuum of noise. You know, there's no noise if somebody's listening, it's music.
Okay. And would it matter if you'd invented this in some digital workshop, these sounds?
Yes, it would.
It would matter.
Yes.
Tell me why. Because to the listener, you know, Maupassant, he said, realists are just the best liars. So actually, it wouldn't matter, would it?
Well, I don't know if I could have simulated this sound so readily in an electronic music studio. I probably could have, but I find that the sounds I find in real situations have a sort of richness to them and a timbre to them that would be hard to find. I mean, if you listen closely to this hydrophone that's sort of plunged into this fast-moving water under in the Teddington Weir, I mean, how would you imagine that sound if you hadn't found it?
You're of the same generation as Terry Riley.
Yes.
And that group. And actually, this water doesn't sound a million miles from certain minimalist sort of rhetoric.
Right, well, it is. It is part of that tradition, I suppose.
And are you still a composer in music who uses natural sounds? If somebody asks you that, what's on your passport?
Well, I mean, I regard myself as a composer, but I mean, I don't write music with notes. I write music with my ears.
In those circumstances, of course, there's also there's a long history of making music about the sea, you know,
yes,
from Debussy through to and so on and so on. Are you part of that tradition too?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, for example, I have a permanent installation outside of London in Greenwich at the National Maritime Museum. About 10, 11 years ago, when they opened that new building, they'd actually commissioned me to make a study of the sound of the sea along the British coast. And they asked me to select what I thought was the most musical and interesting one. And I fell in love with Chesil Beach in Dorset. And if you go into the entrance of the National Maritime Museum, you'll actually hear a permanent installation based on Chesil Beach.
Now, we're hearing what keeps coming, which I assume is the bell of a buoy.
There's a bell buoy out in the Thames Estuary and a foghorn.
And that's, I mean, there's a line of T.S. Eliot's I can't remember from the four quartets about that. And of course, I thought of the opening of Dry Salvages, you know, the dark god is a sullen dark god, the river. I mean, has literature sort of entered your mind when you think of these places? Are you a real composer for whom the word doesn't matter any more than the image?
Well, the word kind of matters to me after the fact, but I think the initial fact is kind of more the ecstasy of discovering the sound.
Now we're going to go actually indoors down a long corridor where there's a very, at the far end, there is a projection of what looks to me like, is it Chelsea Bridge or Victoria?
A tower bridge.
A tower bridge.
And I was fascinated by this, the view of this, because you see this large circular image. It's sort of like an eye, and it's like a London eye.
Of course, as we come to Tower Bridge, one of the things that it makes me think is the Thames has been a place of power.
Yes.
You know, a profound place. And of course, where we stood at Somerset House, as far as I remember, the man who built Somerset House, the Duke of Somerset, was in the end executed for treason,
right,
to Besmar. Now, I'm interested, what are the limits to what you do? Because to put it this way, Bill, what are the sounds of power? How do you give power a sound? Because this place, the Thames, have been profoundly sounds
I'll
of power.
I'll show you.
Okay, you show us.
Because this part of Somerset House has a nickname. It's called the Death House. Because when we come to the end of this passage, you'll see the gravestones that relate to the Catholic nobility that used to inhabit this building. And this is perhaps my favorite one.
Do you want to read it to us?
Well,
you see it?
I see it. It says Dr. Flavius.
Yeah, I need better light in order to see that. But tell me why this attracts you.
Well, because graphically you have the image of a skull and crossbones. And it's just sort of a power. It's a power here because of the architecture creates this sort of reverberation in the low frequencies. And the sound that's causing that is I took underwater recording of the Thames that had some deep frequencies in it, and when I play it just out of the subwoofers here, it really makes the space boom.
It has a curious kind of elegiac air to it.
Yeah, I would say that.
Bill Fontana, thank you very much. Bill Fontana. And River Sounding runs at Somerset House in London until the end of May.